This is the American Ag Network Week in Review. In the show today, Rusty Halvorsen gets us caught up on the week's top news.
Precision agriculture on the menu at a conference coming up this Monday, Tuesday. We had a visit about that topic.
This is Terry Griffin. I am on faculty as an associate professor in the Department of Agricultural Economics at Kansas State University. I'm the cropping systems economist and precision ag economist.
Well, I tell you what, a little background about yourself. Thank you for that. But let's talk about that 9th annual Ag Precision Summit that's going to be going on here in North Dakota. Will you be attending the event?
I will. I'm delivering the keynote address on Monday morning on January 20th, and as well as moderating a all-star panel of speakers. I've actually was on the program at the very first one 9 years ago as delivering a keynote then as well. So this is probably my fourth or fifth time being at the Precision Ag Summit.
Okay, and obviously the summit has probably evolved over the years. Is there anything specifically we're bringing new to the table for this 9th annual summit?
Yes, there is. So it's really remarkable looking at the history of precision agriculture of how much things have changed and also some things that have not changed much at all. For instance, we're going to be discussing on the panel discussion the variable rate technology. Why hasn't it been adopted by a critical mass of farmers like other technologies such as automated guidance and section control? In the lifespan of this summit, over the last 9 years, automated guidance has nearly become ubiquitous across all cropping systems farmers, whereas the data technology, such as yield monitors and variable rate applications, precision soil sampling, have not followed the same adoption paths.
Yeah, and that's very true. Do you think, this is kind of a broad question, and it's about rural broadband. Is the connectivity there for everybody to utilize some of these latest features that we have, some of the latest technology? In your opinion, what do you think?
So across most of the Great Plains or even crop-producing areas across the United States, broadband connectivity has not been sufficient for us to make the most use of precision agriculture. This is true from pushing yield monitor data files from harvesters to the cloud. You know, a lot of times we will still have to move that data by physically moving flash media. Even if we wait a few days, weeks until we get that machine to the headquarters, we still may not have adequate wireless connectivity. So it's been a major limitation at the farm level, but you know, it just doesn't stop there either. If we think about all the efforts to gather data across thousands of farms, you know, think of big data in agriculture, you know, that is not going to be fully operational until we've solved the rural broadband issues.
And I think a lot of growers would like to embrace the technology just because of our ag economy, the cost of inputs. Everybody wants to be as efficient as possible. This is obviously one way to do it. But again, without those tools at their disposal, it's, I would say, a little bit frustrating.
Sure. You know, farm data, you know, from yield monitors and as-applied application of fertilizers and seeding and crop protection chemicals empower farmers to make better farm management decisions if that farmer is poised and ready to make use of that data, if they have capacity to allocate to make decisions that are, you know, more complicated than they were in the past. So farm data hasn't made life easier, but if farmers have capacity to make use of it, it empowers them to be able to make better farm management decisions in the season and in the next growing season.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to ask you, I'm going to take a wild guess that you do probably have some notes prepared for your keynote address. How is this year's address going to differ from that one 9 years ago, do you think, Terry?
Well, one of the things I'm going to talk about is how the different generations of farm operators behave differently. So in the popular culture, we see there's differences between baby boomers and millennials and so forth, and there's been some tension between the groups. We've seen some somewhat derogatory comments from younger generations of okay boomer.
Okay boomer.
Okay boomer. And I want to look at how each of these generations have invested in agricultural technology differently and compare and contrast. There's some similarities as well and some differences. And I'm going to challenge the farmers, the growers in the audience to think about how they're going to do things today and into the future, but also, challenge the ag retailers and the manufacturers that, folks in their 20s and 30s are going to behave very differently than the current baby boomers who currently control over half of all farms across the Great Plains.
Now, again, the summit coming up here in just a bit. What were the exact dates of that again?
It's going to be January 20 and 21 on Monday and Tuesday.
Okay, Monday and Tuesday. And you're coming to North Dakota. Please bring a hat and a pair of gloves and wear boots if you can.
Yes, sir. I'm going to bring some blankets. I'm going to drive up and prepare for a worst-case scenario.
Okay. Well, I hope Mother Nature cooperates and everything works out, and I sure appreciate your time this morning. Thanks for visiting with us, Terry.
Sure thing, Rusty. I'm looking forward to it.
Okay. Safe travels and take care. The Phase One trade agreement between the U.S. and China, signed this past week, calls for China to buy at least $40 billion in agricultural products each of the next 2 years. That according to the White House. However, the trade agreement doesn't specifically require China to lower its punitive tariffs on agricultural products, which include 25% retaliatory tariffs on soybeans and tariffs on some agricultural goods as high as 90%. Farmers for Free Trade co-director Brian Keel is treating Phase One with caution.
The U.S. put tariffs on Chinese imports. China retaliated by putting tariffs on U.S. exports, mainly farm products. That's what's really whacked our farm economy. Soybean exports plummeted by 94%. I mean, it really, really has hammered our farmers. And this deal on its face doesn't resolve a lot of that. We're leaving in place tariffs on Chinese imports of over $300 billion in products every year. So the vast majority of products coming from China into the U.S. are still going to have tariffs or added taxes put on them. And China's not lifting their retaliatory tariffs on U.S. ag products. What this deal does do is it holds off on new tariffs, so it keeps things from getting worse, knock on wood. And the Trump administration is saying that China is committing to buying $40 to $50 billion in ag products every year. People, I think, are skeptical of that because, number one, we've never seen that level of purchasing from China. The high was $23, $24 billion in ag purchases by the Chinese from the U.S., so this would be roughly a doubling of that. And remember, as I just said, the Chinese aren't removing their tariffs on ag products, so it's going to be more expensive to sell into China. It's hard to square that idea that we're not cost competitive with the idea that somehow we're going to see our exports increase by that magnitude. China can put its thumb on the scale. It can waive some of these tariffs and boost some exports now. But I think a lot of us are taking a wait-and-see attitude because it doesn't seem to add up. I wouldn't rush out and buy a new pickup truck just yet.
The Senate on Thursday voting 89-10 for final passage of the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, USMCA, sending the trade deal to President Trump to sign into law. Given that Mexico has already approved the trade deal, getting the pact into implementation will now fall to Canada's government to ratify the agreement. USMCA is expected to boost national exports roughly $68 billion a year, that according to an International Trade Commission report last spring. While ag exports are only pegged to rise roughly 1.6%, supporters said that the trade deal provides certainty. Again, Brian Keel with Farmers for Free Trade.
When you think about it, so U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement is the new NAFTA. It updates NAFTA. And it improves NAFTA. It's not a dramatically different agreement from NAFTA, but it has some improvements, and it modernizes NAFTA, which was passed in 1994. I think the biggest thing that it does, though, is it removes the cloud. When President Trump came into office, he was threatening to pull us out of NAFTA. We immediately got into a trade war with Mexico and Canada where we were putting tariffs on their steel and aluminum, and they were putting tariffs on our ag products, which really hurt a lot of our ag producers, you know, dairy, pork, apples, corn. This removes all of that. So it kind of puts us back to where we were, moves the ball a little bit forward. But I think the biggest thing that it does is it really just it stabilizes those relationships. Those are two of our largest trading partners, and to be getting out from under a trade war really in itself is a win.
Farmers for Free Trade recently sent a letter to congressional leaders from over 2,200 farmers calling for passage of USMCA.
U.S.-Mexico trade, we export about $20 billion in products to Mexico and $20 billion each year to Canada in ag products. So those are two of our biggest export markets. China is the third, with also about historically about $20 billion. So those three are our biggest markets. Getting those stabilized and back on track are critically important. But we can't lose sight of the fact that there are a lot of mouths outside of China, outside of Canada and Mexico. So expanding export opportunities into Japan, into Vietnam, into the EU, into the UK, into South America, these are things we should also be working on. We need to be expanding export opportunities, not just stabilizing ones we've already had.
Among the major winners in the trade deal are dairy producers who will receive more export opportunities into Canada's managed dairy market. Tom Vilsack, president and CEO of the U.S. Dairy and Export Council, says one of the next steps will be to make sure the deal is enforceable. The U.S. dairy industry has had some issues with its neighbors to the north.
Our Canadian friends are pretty good at this trade business, and they have a tendency to reinterpret agreements after they've been reached. And so we're going to want to make sure that as they're fulfilling their quota responsibilities, that they're doing it in the right way, in a transparent way. We're going to want to make sure that as they eliminate Class 7 and replace it with a system that's going to be tied more to our Class 4 milk pricing, that they don't figure out a way to sort of get themselves in the same situation they were in with Class 7, just a different name. The reality is they have a supply management system up there, and the reality is they can't manage their supply within the four corners of Canada, which is why they tried to export their problem to the rest of the world, and in doing so undercut all the other dairy countries and the dairy farmers of other countries. So we want to make sure that this is implemented properly. And the good news about the USMCA is that in addition to the opportunities that it creates, it also has developed a dispute mechanism, a dispute resolution mechanism that will allow us, if there is a problem, to be able to rectify that problem a lot sooner than we would have under NAFTA that had no dispute resolution system. We won't have to go through a WTO long drawn out process. There is a way in which the three countries can come together and resolve any concerns that people have about the implementation. So I think that's a very positive aspect of this agreement, and it's one of the reasons why we're seeing pretty significant bipartisan support for the trade agreement, both in the House and this week in the Senate.
While soybeans are getting a lot of attention related to the Phase 1 trade deal with China, others are hoping for more sales of their products. Scott Richmond, chief economist for the Renewable Fuels Association, is cautiously optimistic about ethanol sales to China.
You know, China is kind of in fits and starts moving toward E10. I've been looking at that market long enough to remember that in the early to mid-2000s, they were introducing pilot programs in a number of provinces and cities. And they've at times put that on hold a little bit, but they have advanced that over the years and are pretty substantial users of ethanol. Their domestic industry can't quite make enough ethanol for what they want to use, and so the U.S. industry is has the capacity to help out and to help their air quality in the cities over there, and so we are waiting to see exactly what the terms of the deal will be. But even if it's not national E10, even if it's just further moves in that process toward E10, it could be good for our producers.
China is one of several countries looking to increase the use of ethanol.
We've we've been working with our industry partners, especially the U.S. Grains Council, and they've been looking to open up markets in a number of priority countries. China's one. India is also a potential. It's a large market now, but it's a potential very large market, and even closer to home, trying to work with authorities and industry participants in Mexico to further open that market. There's definitely potential on the international front.
Chinese officials haven't confirmed any details of the second phase of the trade plan, and instead have said that any future negotiations depend on how the Phase 1 deal is implemented. Chinese Vice Premier Liu He spoke during the signing ceremony in Washington, D.C. with the help of an interpreter.
I hope the U.S. side will treat fairly Chinese companies and their regular trade and investment activities and give support to the collaboration between enterprises, research institutes, and schools and colleges of the two countries, as it will help enhance mutual trust and cooperation between us.
出发愿与美方相向而行，我愿与你保持密切的联系，相信在我们共同引领下，中美关系在新的一年能够给两国人民带来更多利益和实惠。
China is prepared to work with the U.S. in that direction, and I will stay in close touch with you personally. I believe that under our guidance, China-U.S. relations will deliver more results and bring greater benefits to our peoples in the year ahead.
再过几天就是中国农历春节了，我和我的夫人彭丽媛祝总统先生、梅拉尼亚女士和家人新春快乐。 祝事顺遂.
The Chinese Lunar New Year is just a few days away. I and my wife, Peng Liyuan, extend our season's greetings to you, to Melania, and your family. May you all enjoy happiness and success in the new year.
Thank you. Thank you.
That's what's happening in agriculture. I'm Rusty Halverson.
This has been the American Ag Network Week in Review. I'm Sabrina Hill. For Rusty Halverson and myself, thanks for listening. Join us again next week.